UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK charity working to make integrative oncology, a broad approach to cancer care that includes lifestyle and complementary medicine to improve outcomes and quality of life, available to all. Dr. Larry Sherwitz is a true pioneer in this field, creating some of the scientific evidence for the adoption of lifestyle approaches in his lifetime of research, latterly in his groundbreaking work with Dr. Dean Ornish. Larry, very honoured to have you as my guest on the Yes Life Show.
I'm honoured to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So you're someone with a very long and distinguished career in medicine, notably in research, and I want to hear a little bit about before we go on, if I can. I wonder if you mind starting out by telling us what got you into the arena in the first place, and maybe just share one or two of the things that you feel are highlights of your work.
Well, in my undergraduate research, I began doing research in social psychology. I was focusing on interpersonal attraction, and then I saw the connection between the heart and interpersonal attraction, so I started research on how eye contact and nonverbal communication, what people say, affect how much you're attracted to another person. And then I needed to measure those effects. So I started looking at the heart, the autonomic nervous system, and then that led to looking at funding for my research. And the best source of funding was looking at heart disease. And as psychology started moving into heart disease with things like type A behavior and so forth, I became more deeply involved with looking at what causes and how to prevent heart disease, how to treat it and how to prevent it. And then I expanded that, and I did some research with cancer and other diseases. And so I've spread into mind-body to mind medicine. And I've seen the field progress from psychosomatic medicine with a small coterie of dedicated researchers to behavioral medicine, and now we have lifestyle medicine. And I've witnessed its adoption and the changes over time, which are very encouraging. We think the change is slow, but when we take a 50-year perspective,
it's true. You need a bit of perspective, don't you? Because it is slow, but and along the way, it seems like nothing's happening. But when you look back, yeah, it's true. You can actually see it has changed. I can see that over 20 years now, that things happen now that just couldn't possibly have happened 20 years ago. So it's heartening to see that. What an interesting entry point, though, you had there of looking at starting off from relationships.
Yes.
In some ways, you're talking about coming around full circle. So those are the kind of things that are actually talked about as medicine now. So of course, our social connections and personal relations, if they're bad, that's going to affect our health.
Indeed. And now we have evidence to that effect and good review studies that support it. And your National Health Service is looking at social connection as a treatment modality.
Good job. We like it. That's, yeah, really interesting. And so, yeah, anything that you're particularly proud of pushing the boundaries of research in, do you think things that have notably had an impact?
Well, one of the areas of research that I did and I'm known for in some circles is how speech characteristics can predict future heart disease.
Wow.
And in a serendipitous finding, we discovered that self-references in response to interview questions, self-references meaning I, me, mine, mine, was a predictor of future heart attacks independent of all the other risk factors.
You're kidding. Okay. Heard this.
And so being self-focused is anxiety producing. It's a root of hostility and so forth. And being other-focused is transcendence, and being focused on pets, plants, and people besides myself is a healing way of looking at life.
Well, that's fascinating stuff. Yeah. I mean, pets, as soon as you say that, well, of course, more and more, they're actually seeing animals as therapy for people, aren't they? of which they are, of course, they can be enormously healing. But yeah, that direction of your attention being fundamentally outward or fundamentally inward, you can see all the anxiety and everything that you just described and what effect that would have on your health. How fascinating. So that's a predictor of heart disease, you say, yeah?
Yes, it is. In epidemiological studies I had conducted, the people who used mine frequently in answer to questions about their daily habits and lifestyle were more prone to having heart attacks. And smoking wasn't a predictor of heart disease unless people use those self-references. I'm not suggesting anybody's take up or smoking by any means, but it's all integrated. These risk factors are not just individual entities. They are all part of an integrated matrix in the body.
I'm very glad to hear you say that thing because, so often a piece of research seems to jump to a huge conclusion, being a bit fat, for example, means you're at risk from cancer. But of course, there are lots of other things. If you're a bit fat, but actually you have this amazing lifestyle, superb relationships with everybody, feel integrated in the community, love your life and have a huge amount of meaning and purpose, maybe it doesn't matter at all. You're a bit overweight. It's all one thing, isn't it? You can't pick out bits of it and draw huge conclusions about an association.
Well, that's right. We like to use a statistical technique called multiple regression that is to control for one factor while looking at the effect of another factor.
Okay.
But that's not the way the body reacts.
Right.
The body is a central mechanism where everything is contributing to the sum.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Thanks for sharing that. It's really interesting stuff. Okay, so I want to dedicate the show to pulling right back, giving an overview of developments progress in the field of integrative oncology internationally, and because that's what we're interested in, and a bit about the national variations within that, as well as your views on what the drivers of change are and have been, and the current direction of travel. So first of all, maybe we start looking at lifestyle medicine as a credible modality. How do you think its status has advanced in your lifetime? And what do you think have been the main drivers for any change there?
I'll answer the second part of your question.
Okay.
First, there are two major drivers. One is the public's acceptance and demand and asking about these modalities. And there's more public acceptance of various elements of lifestyle than there was in the past. That is one driver from the bottom up.
Right, grassroots.
The other from top down is the research evidence showing its effectiveness. And that affects societies, organizations, medical care, medical education, and so forth. So those are two twin drivers from the top down and from the bottom up.
Mm.
And I see that continuing. Lifestyle medicine is getting a toehold into prescribed care slowly and somewhat unevenly, but the trend is positive.
Yeah, yes, that's what we need to move towards for sure, an alternative to the type of idea of care that we're getting at the moment. Really interesting. Yeah, yes, I experienced both those things. Interestingly, our experience here in the UK was that a big driver of that rise in acceptance and awareness in the public was actually COVID-19. That period seemed to be a period during which the importance of lifestyle seemed to really ramp up very quickly in a short period, the way it's perceived by the public. Have you had a similar experience?
Well, yes and no. What COVID did is it isolated individuals. We jumped on the internet. We use Zoom. We didn't go to the office. So there are those factors that put a distance between us. Our connections to people are now through electronics. And the presence of a person, their vibe, or whatever we want to call it, is
Yeah.
reduced when it's articulated through electronics. So that's one thing. But being at home and taking care of yourself is a trend that COVID may have pr promoted. We had to mask and vaccinate and so forth. And yes, it's had mixed effects as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Yeah. I think it, I thought about it a lot and why this should be. And in some ways, I think that having things that are taken for granted removed, for instance, you haven't given anybody a hug for 6 months, or you haven't been out in nature in ages, whatever, the appreciation for these things and how much they play into our sense of well-being has risen in response. I live in the country here. I tell you, when people were first allowed to go for walks in the country, we were buried. We're just like people were desperate to get out into nature, which of course will have made them feel better instantly. And so they would have had a sort of first-hand experience, if you like, of how good it is to get out in nature, which maybe before they hadn't thought about. And yeah, there seem to be several ways in which people got a chance to reevaluate the things they, really did appreciate and did actually form part of their life and well-being. So here at Yes Alive, we just felt that, before COVID, well-being was a thing strictly limited to a bunch of hippies here and there. But after COVID, well-being was something that everybody talked about. It was on the TV, in the media. And it had just gained status as being a real thing. And of course, it was recognized that if you didn't have well-being, you were really vulnerable to COVID. It made the difference between a nasty flu and potentially death if you had general good background well-being. So anyway, interesting time, I thought.
Well, it's the poor well-being during COVID prompted the drive to good well-being. It was a bouncing effect.
That's great. And since then we have had I feel some genuine government initiatives, health service initiatives in this country to actually directly address that to some extent. Of course, it's always less and slower than we'd like, but compared to before, it's something rather than nothing. Yeah, it's a good direction. I was thinking about, other things that are drivers. I feel there's been the whole situation around diabetes. I know you've been involved in research around diabetes, I believe, as well. Is that correct?
Well, it wasn't a focus in terms of specific aims in our research projects, but it was something we monitored among patients who had diabetes. We looked at the A1C and the reduced need for medication, the weight loss, and those factors. And our lifestyle program with a four component program of stress management, exercise, social support, and diet all improve the status of diabetes, and we had isolated cases where there's remission. That is, the diabetes went away. And now you have two studies published in the UK that have directed your national health insurance to focus on remission by radical weight loss.
Fantastic, isn't it? That is a radical change. Well, I was thinking of that one. I think that has had a lot of impact because it actually had both the ingredients you described. It was initially very grassroots, I think. Literally, lots of people got together, shared their data online about how they'd managed to reverse diabetes. But at the same time, there's a certain amount of study going on and science being built up to show that this was really true. And the two things have come together to bring about, in medical terms, quite a rapid change from, an increasing number of drugs over a long period of time, usually with a rather sticky end, to actual remission, which wasn't possible before then. So it's been a very interesting.
UK health. the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
They feel so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
The station that makes you feel good.
Well, I'd like to talk about remission for a moment.
Go.
In these two studies, it's tied directly to how much weight is lost.
Okay.
And the more weight you lose and the more weight you maintain as lost, the better chance you have remission. And how can that be? Well, here's one thing. The human body is designed for feast and famine.
Mm-hmm.
It is designed not to waste one calorie, and it will save it even after we fill all our adipose tissue, which is designed to store fat. It will save it in between our organs, in our organs, including liver, and probably even our pancreas. What's wonderful, though, is when you start to lose weight, the body selects those places where the fat was not meant to be. If you have fatty tissue in between your organs or in your organs, that's not a good place for it. It doesn't get nourished as well. It causes inflammation. Inflammation is a root cause of chronic disease. So the body selects those places where it shouldn't be stored first. So the first 10 pounds you lose are going to have the biggest effect on your health. And as you lose those abdominal fat, there's how the pancreas can work better. Insulin resistance goes down. That's the explanation, I think, in how weight loss leads to a remission of diabetes. Now, in these studies, what it shows, when you go back to gaining weight, the diabetes comes back. So it's not an irreversible remission.
No. It's dependent on your condition. Yeah. Yeah, really interesting. So that's heartening news. It's the first thing that goes, is the bit that causes the trouble. And of course, because, as you say, it's inflammatory, it's worth knowing for people with any chronic disease, in fact, including cancer, that is likely to be an unhelpful thing to have going on, that kind of inflammation.
Indeed. I think the trend in lifestyle and integrative medicine is implementation. We no longer just believe it's a good advice. We need to practice it.
Right.
National Health Service is doing very well with moving in that direction, committing to a remission of diabetes, but also social integration. You have social prescribing now.
Yeah.
Connecting people to the environment by referring them to civic organizations and other social support mechanisms.
Yeah. That is a very great initiative, I must say. Yeah, social prescribing. And it is offering GPs, general practice doctors, a genuine alternative to doling out the pills, which has to be good, and actually directly addressing issues like being lonely, isolated, for example. So fantastic, I agree. The thing I want to see next is I want to see the government put some money behind it, because at the moment it relies far too heavily on charitable organizations, etc., to actually deliver, they're still not seen as delivering medicine. You know, that they, the social prescribing scheme pays for the people who do the signposting and all that kind of thing, and the mechanism that actually sends patients out to and looks in every area and find out what resources are there, but the money is not put into the actual pastimes. You know, you could, if you're somebody who runs forest bathing, you're not going to get paid by the NHS to do it yet. But I want to see that as the next step. It's important where the money goes in the end. But I agree with you. It's very good that we're actually doing it.
I would like to see that too. The same thing happens in the States. We're reducing the funding for research, for example. In the States, we need Medicare for all, and we need a focus system-wide on healthy lifestyle changes. But it's happening. Let's be patient.
We have to be, and well, I'm not. But anyway, I have to be. I think, it, you know, we kind of an impatient attitude is actually needed for change to happen even slowly. We have to absolutely be battering on the door all the time just to drive it along. But yeah, it's a great initiative, social prescribing, though. I'm very happy about it, I must say. And it's also very heartening to hear an American telling us we're ahead on something in the UK because we're not used to it. Yeah. So talking about drivers of change in lifestyle medicine, I just were interested to compare two things. We've got nutrition and exercise. Now, if we look in cancer, particularly, nutrition as a potential way of helping people with cancer has been around for more than 100 years. And exercise has really, well, it has been around since about the 1980s, I understand, but really it didn't start to appear as anything serious until this century, I think. But comparatively, yeah, exercise has sprung out of nowhere. And in some countries, it's like, well, it's mainstream. It's not here, of course, but it certainly is in some places, parts of America, that's true. And in Australia, it's true that they take exercise very seriously. Why? Well, it's actually damn good medicine, that's why. And it's just interesting to compare these two things. Nutrition, meanwhile, has languished. There's no nutritionists anywhere near our hospitals. And the only areas in which it's made any inroads are the ketogenic diet and with the potential for improving treatments by paying attention to the gut microbiome. Those are the only two areas in which there's been any interest in nutrition, really. So I'm just interested to hear your thoughts about those two very different scenarios.
Well, the research is supporting a whole food plant-based diet. And that was a study done in the Marshall Islands, published in 2024, compared the standard diet with a whole food plant-based diet. Those who had the whole food diet had a much greater chance of improving their diabetes metabolics, getting rid of the disease, losing weight, losing the glucose levels. So I think that should be a major focus. And a lot of research, and my wife and I have just done a review article on this, shows that a ultra-processed diet is the root cause of obesity and many of the associated diseases related to obesity. Ultra-processed foods lose their life force. So if you're in a grocery store, focus on peripheral shopping. Shopping for those things that are refrigerated, like lettuce and carrots and so forth. And watch what you eat in those aisles with all that packaged food. Because once it's been industrially processed, it loses its integrity and it loses the life force. And we want to preserve that in our diet. And I think, I know that vegetarianism is very popular in England, more so than in the States.
Is that true?
So,
yeah. Okay.
We need to get political, not only take care of our health, but take care of how our agencies focus on promoting health. And letter writing and campaigning and so forth can have an effect with a few people. We've seen it many, many times. So persist. Persist with your doctors. Persist with your legislators. Persist with your media. Keep the drum beat going about nutrition. It's the major thing that was in remission for these diabetes studies done in the UK.
Right. Yeah. Well, I agree. I mean, anybody in integrative oncology, it'll be one of the first things on the table, as nutrition is one of the key things for people to look at. What do they eat? How do they eat? And why? Because of the effects it can have in either direction, pulling you down or lifting you up out of cancer. And it's just not even seen as a factor in the whole thing at all in UK oncology. It's not considered at all. In fact, they just give people advice that tell them it doesn't matter what they eat, just to keep their weight up, you know. Or the best advice they're likely to get is eat a good balanced diet. Nobody knows what that is, but they're told to do it. And so it's interesting that to me, one of the differences, I think about the differences between exercise and nutrition, is that, yeah, there are all those aisles you just described, full of stuff, which is making money, basically. And there's a lot of interest in food having nothing to do with health. It doesn't matter. The idea that it doesn't matter what you eat is very palatable to industry. They wouldn't want food to be seen as a medicine that you need to be very picky about. But that's not really true about exercise. There's not an industry that's hell-bent on you not having exercise. So that seems to me to be a key factor in this, is that there are less obstacles to the progress of exercise as medicine, and hence it's been able to make its way quite quickly into the mainstream. Do you see that as a factor?
Yes, I agree with everything you said. Big food has money for marketing.
Exactly.
And that has a big influence in their sports programs. You see, fast food advertised and hamburgers and things. And that has a big force. So big food and big pharmacy are factors we have to contend with to have a healthy lifestyle and have a healthy public.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Yeah, lifestyle medicine, as you and I know, is about a lot more than just the physical things. You've obviously, a lot of your work has been researching into the arenas of the psychological, the spiritual, the emotional as well. And I think we would both agree, are key elements of our well-being. And you were speaking at our recent conference, which is directly addressing those areas as connected to our well-being. And there's just the beginnings of recognition in oncology that, for example, that a large proportion of people who get a cancer diagnosis as a result have PTSD. You know, this is something that was normally applied to people who'd been in a war or something. It's that level of crisis for people. And there are, in the best places, is one or two efforts to give some sort of psychological support. But lifestyle medicine, yeah, takes a much broader sweep than that. It doesn't just say, okay, give them a little bit of CBT therapy, you know, or something. We'll look at it in a much broader manner, as you said, as a whole, us being all connected and that everything matters. That's quite a big discussion for our healthcare services around the world to take in that idea that cancer is to do with our spiritual well-being, for example. Do you think that's a possibility?
I think it's being increasingly recognized. In your conference, Purpose in Life was a cancer survivor mechanism.
Absolutely.
Why you get out of bed in the morning is a factor in whether you can survive cancer diagnosis. It's probably a factor in whether you get cancer. A purpose in life, your connections to something bigger than yourself, whether it be your family, a cause, a civic organization, some reason to live. So will to live is an extremely important. And Sigmund Freud was criticized in the turn of the 19th to the 20th century for proposing that there is a death wish instinct.
Mm.
And we have seen this in our research when we offer people a comprehensive lifestyle program and they refuse and they don't want to live because they don't have a reason. They don't feel life is fulfilling. And when the mind body gets this message, dying is an exit. It is a way we get out of
the situation.
And dealing with this existential level, knowing that we have a mechanism to die and we have a mechanism to live, and appreciating that balance.
Well, it's really interesting what you're saying, because of course this is hugely plays into the way that our healthcare services address issues around cancer, for example, or any life-threatening disease. The whole thing about people getting a prognosis which says, right, well, you've got this long to live. What effect that has on somebody when they accept that. As you say, the will to live is an extraordinarily important part of our continued well-being and survival. Without it, well, you know, we're hopeless, and without any hope, we fizzle away, basically. We do actually die. On a certain level, it's sort of simple and dead obvious, but it doesn't seem to stop the doling out of death sentences that goes on in oncology, for example, where people are told with certainty, oh, yes, you won't live more than 3 months, as if people know what's going to happen in the future. So, very interesting area to look at. And in terms of our well-being, incredibly fundamental. sitting underneath everything else?
Well, I think this whole move, I don't know how it's going in the UK, of euthanasia.
Yeah.
Providing that as an exit, a supported exit, is a good way to have a person decide whether they want to live or not. Dying is not the end, as far as I'm concerned. It is a transition. So I think the euthanasia option is a philosophical question.
Hmm.
You want this out, or do you want to fight, or do you want to mend? Do you want to heal? And having that discussion internally is an important thing to do. And then the decision then leads to a planning, and the planning leads to action. And those steps should be taken. So it's a philosophical question that could be delved in, that is prompted by a cancer diagnosis, once it's handled well.
It's interesting that you're right. It's prompted by the diagnosis, in as much as that people may have never considered really whether they want to live or not. They're just stumbling on. But underlying it could be a desire to not really be here. And it gets kind of uncovered and revealed by something like cancer in a way that maybe it hasn't before. And something that, it becomes an option, if you like. Oh, this is a way out where there wasn't one before. It's a funny thing. We can sort of wish that people would want to be alive and want to be here, but that's not true of everybody. And who are we to say they should?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. So, yeah, it is right. It's a philosophical question, as you say. But, the euthanasia discussion in this country is moving slowly forward. I think it will be a thing eventually. But it's taking its time, as most things do. So what do you reckon? Do you foresee a day when doctors around the world, they're routinely prescribing like sleep hygiene or time in nature or joining a gym rather than doling out pharmaceuticals to suppress the bad symptoms they're having and getting people addicted and giving them lots of side effects as well at the same time? Do you think that kind of, that they will ever gain equivalence?
Well, you know, Dean Ornish once said, we don't practice preventive medicine. We practice reimbursement medicine.
Reimbursement is a good way of putting it. Yes, okay.
Yeah, doctors get money for prescribing procedures.
Mm-hmm.
They get a way out of writing a prescription pad and feeling like they've done something for patients. These lifestyle components we're talking about are not reimbursed. It takes time to coach somebody, to educate them and motivate them and monitor them. And that's not written into the money dynamics, the time dynamics. And hopefully that's going to shift, that we get paid for taking a half hour to an hour for a patient to make a major transformational change.
Yeah, no, I see that entirely. And that's, I gave an example of that with social prescribing. The money needs to get in there as well, because then you know they mean it. it's actually being taken seriously.
Yes.
Yeah, we've had a situation in this country where we don't have integrative oncology. It doesn't exist. It's much further advanced in the US than it is here. But what we do have is we have complementary health units, usually somewhere attached or within a cancer hospital. And they are entirely, and have been for 25, 30 years, they're run on charity generally. I mean, I understand there are one or two places where they've actually coughed up the money. But generally speaking, you've got practitioners doing it for nothing to help the patients out. The whole thing's run by a charity. It costs the NHS nothing. And the deal for having them there in the hospital goes something like, well, as long as you don't claim that you're doing anything whatsoever that's doing these patients any good who've got cancer, and it's just a nice to have, you can stay here and don't ask us for any money. That's the deal. And they're not taking it seriously. They're just putting up with it. And so you're right, reimbursement, that's what it's all about. When people get reimbursed, it gets serious. So we've got the challenge of things like, you know, obesity blockbuster drugs. That's a challenge to lifestyle medicine, isn't it? Because lifestyle medicine has been for ages been saying, come on, obesity is a lifestyle issue. We need to tackle it at its root. And then along comes there, take this pill and it'll get sorted out. So, you know, what do we do with that?
Well, nutrition is one of the most reductionistic fields of research and therapy. We started by looking at scurvy and making limes. The limeys were UK sailors.
Yes.
And it hasn't changed that much. So it's a reductionistic field. And we need to embody it with customs. We need to embody it with care for food. We need to embody it with mindfulness. We need to embody it with social support. Nutrition needs to have its things around it.
You're right.
Now, GLP-1 drugs is a shortcut.
Yeah.
And it is very effective to weight loss because it cuts down on appetite. The way lifestyle medicine is evolved around it is when you eat less, you need to eat with more nutrition density.
Right.
That is, with every calorie, you need more vitamins, minerals, and phytochemicals and so forth. And so you have to eat more nutritiously or you're going to have a deficiency. And the other thing is that obesity is driven by emotional eating, distracted eating, addiction to certain foods. This is going to interfere with long-term weight maintenance, weight loss maintenance. So that's where lifestyle medicine comes into play, dealing with these need for food to feel better. We have a loneliness culture. We have a culture full of stress, and we use food as a soothing thing. Eating something sweet helps with the serotonin, helps us feel better for a little while before the insulin knocks it down and we feel worse later. But overeating is a way we use to cope with life. And the GLP-1 drugs don't address that coping mechanism. So it needs support around it. The GLP-1 drugs need support. And it's easy for a doctor to write a prescription for it. But your healthcare system is struggling with how you pay for it. It's expensive. And I imagine it's expensive in the UK as it is in the States.
Probably.
How's that going?
I actually don't know, but I mean, all I do know is that the obesity is going very well, where you may be the front runners in America, but we're doing a great job at trying to catch up. So it's a huge problem for sure with very young people. So, what we're going to do about it, I mean, this drug is not the answer for sure. You can guarantee it isn't the answer for, you just given us lots of reasons why it isn't the answer, and it won't be. But unfortunately, for the idea that we can do something without changing is always appealing to humans, isn't it? We don't like to change, basically. So that's what the pill for all ills promises, that you won't need to change, you just take the pill. And so it's interesting, it still comes down to lifestyle medicine in the end. If you actually want good change, you're right. What you need is things, no drug is something that our body's craving, but good nutrition is. Our body is craving that. So we need to give it to it.
Well, Big Food has used scientists to design food that is palatable, salt, fat, sugar, all mixed in the right proportion to make you want to eat more. And it's overriding our natural intuitive things of what our body needs. when I was a young guy, my family raised hogs, and hogs were smart. They knew when they needed protein. They knew when they needed certain foods, and they would go after those. We've lost some of that intuition with our ultra-processed foods.
Mm. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting the way animals actually know what they need and will eat it. It's fascinating. We must have had that. And we're just going to have to work it out now, since we haven't got the instinct anymore. We have to work it out what the best thing to do is. And we have, to some extent. That is lifestyle medicine. But we're out of time, Larry. Really interesting run around the whole world of integrative medicine and its growth over the years. I hope you're very proud of your contribution to all of that, because it's been significant. And that, in turn, would have benefited vast numbers of people with all sorts of chronic diseases. Just the thing of knowing that diabetes is not something you have to live with. You can actually do something about it. Immense. That is such a change in our whole culture, that is. So, amazing what you've brought in your lifetime to people.
Well, it's a privilege to talk with your listeners. I wish them well. I wish them the initiative to take care of their health. Lifestyle medicine is what you do every day, and it all adds up to better health and better healthy lifespan. So good luck, and bless you all.
Thanks, Larry.
Bye-bye. Take care now.
Fascinating chat. There's always more to learn about lifestyle medicine. The video of Dr. Sherwitz's talk at our recent online conference, Reclaiming Our True Nature, is available from the Yes to Life online store, which you can find a link to right at the top of any page of the charity's main website, yestolife.org.uk. There you'll also find all the other speakers' presentations, and they can be purchased as a bundle of the entire conference. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's a pleasure to be able to introduce amazing guests such as Dr. Sherwitz to you each week. I do hope you'll want to join me again next week, when I'll be back for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.